From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Good evening, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Welcome to our show. Here at the People Speak, we believe when the people do speak, they make a difference. Tonight, this People Speak with Jordan Day, Director of the U.S. Relations of the UN World Food Program. The World Food Program is the largest humanitarian agency, and each year they feed an average of 90 million poor people, including 56 million hungry children in 80 of the world's poorest countries. During his tenure with WFP, Mr. Day has served in Colombia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Panama, Sri Lanka, Washington, New York, and in World Food Program's Rome headquarters. Mr. Day is a frequent media commentator and has often appeared as a guest on CNN, BBC, C-SPAN, Fox News, National Public Radio, and in the pages of the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Mr. Day. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good evening, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's our honor. It's a distinct pleasure to have somebody that has worked with such an impassioned kind of program. How did you get involved in the World Food Program?
Well, I had worked overseas for a number of years with some nonprofits, some non-governmental organizations in Bosnia and in Romania and Kosovo. So there's a bit of a natural extension between working for smaller humanitarian organizations to working for something with more scale and a larger reach, which was the United Nations World Food Program. So I began working with WFP in 2001, and was originally based in Latin America out of Colombia, in Bogota, and then, as you noted, have moved to other areas since then.
We seem to be having a lot of noise, and I'm not sure what it's coming from. I apologize for that. Hopefully this will work. Our technical director will work this out in just a second. You know, I wanted to ask you some questions about the type of work that you do yourself as a director. What really is involved in the kind of work that you do, the type of job, your job description, so to speak?
Sure. Well, the World Food Program is a UN agency. It's the food agency of the United Nations, and we are supported by donor states from countries around the world. The United States is one of those countries, but so too is Japan and Canada, most of Europe, Australia. So our role here in the United States is to manage the relationship with the U.S. government. And that means working with the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. State Department, as well as the White House and Congress, just to ensure that they are aware of the kinds of challenges we're facing around the world, the kind of work that we're doing around the world, and also giving information to them on how their donations and their contributions are being utilized.
You know, as I was doing some research, Jordan, on the type of work that you were doing, I ran across an interesting statement, and I'm going to read this. It was right off your site. In purely quantitative terms, there is enough food available to feed the entire global population of 6.4 billion people, and yet one in nearly seven people are going hungry. One in three children are underweight. Why does hunger exist? Now, that is my question to you. Why, even with the tremendous numbers of people that you're feeding, why does hunger still exist?
Right. Well, it is. There's more than 850 million people who go to bed hungry every night. That is about 1 in 7 people in the world. That falls disproportionately on women and children. They tend to be the most vulnerable. And children are really, really the focus of our work because they are still at a point where if they get proper nutrition, they can develop physically and intellectually with hope. But once they move through their 0 to 5 years period with malnourished bodies, then it's more difficult to get them back up to a physically healthy state. There is enough food produced in the world to feed everyone. It's a matter, of course, of economics and location. The poorest people tend to live in hard-to-reach areas. They tend not to have access to jobs, to earn wages, to buy their food. And those that don't have wage-earning access have to rely on the land. 70% of the world's population are subsistence farmers. And those families, those farmers may have a small plot of land that they themselves own, but generally they have to rent land from larger landowners. And it, of course, takes resources, money to buy some seed. It takes money to buy a plow, and it takes, of course, time and energy. And so those families that are able to plant are generally tend to be entirely dependent on good rainfall during during the growing season. If for any reason there's not good rainfall, then their crop fails. And that may be the crop, the one or two crops that they can plant a year that sustain them. And that puts them in a position of course, extreme vulnerability. They don't have any money to buy in the market. There may not be a market nearby. The crop they've planted has failed due to insufficient rains, due to drought, and there they are. Now, in many countries of the world, there would be some sort of social safety net in place. There might be a government program to provide food assistance to the poorest. There may be a food stamp, some other sort of nutritional support. But the countries that we work in, the governments, by and large, don't have the resources to invest in a safety net, or they are unfortunately using those resources for other activities. They're not budgeting for safety net programs. They're providing that money for militaries or you know other legitimate activities that they have in their country. So we end up working with the poorest of the poor, and what we do is help get food that is either donated to us as a commodity as corn or rice, vegetable oil, or we're given cash and we buy the food locally or regionally, and then we get that out to these hard-to-reach areas and work through local humanitarian organizations to distribute the food to those most in need. We have a pretty sophisticated targeting mechanism. It's called the Vulnerability Analysis and Mapping Unit. And
what is that exactly, Jordan?
Pardon?
What is that exactly?
That's our team that uses a variety of information to pinpoint who the most vulnerable people are in a country. So they look not only at indicators like income, but also at weather pattern, access to market, and what crop harvests have been in an area. So it's really an effort to ensure that the aid gets to those most in need. Politics doesn't interfere with where that food goes, and that we have a mapping system for ensuring that we're targeting the right people. And again, it tends to be, women and children. We're particularly concerned with women who are pregnant or who are breastfeeding because we know that cycle of hunger, that cycle of malnutrition begins in the womb. And if a mother gives birth to a low birth weight baby, then that cycle has begun again. So in addition to feeding young kids, we like to target our food assistance to pregnant women or to lactating women to try to cut that cycle of malnutrition.
You know, when we the issue of hunger is, you know, I found to be very, very prolific. Somewhere I had read once that many people know what hunger is, but very few know what starvation is. And I found that you have a lot of definitive remarks on the site that actually explains and defines exactly what hunger. Why is it such a strange and foreign concept to so many people, Jordan?
Well, I think it's strange to us because we've had the benefit of being born in a country that that doesn't have a widespread hunger problem. There is a hunger problem in the U.S., but it's certainly not to the degree that it is in other countries. So, you know, by virtue or benefit or luck of birth, we've been able to escape a public health problem, a reality that affects an extraordinary amount of people. I mean, we're talking about almost a billion people who literally don't get enough to eat on a daily basis. So I don't know what exactly you turned it to, if it's luck or happenstance, but you know, I certainly didn't choose to be born in the United States, but I was, and you know, I've been able to benefit from the health care, the education, and the access to employment and food that's come along with that. That's not the case for those who are born in North Korea or Darfur or, you know, the Somali region of Ethiopia. There's just a lot of people living in very, very limited means. And really what we need to see for a longer-term solution is that governments make the right investments. It's important to invest in healthcare systems, basic healthcare systems out in the rural areas, so that the poorest families aren't spending their very limited money or resources on emergency healthcare. They also need to have access. Diarrhea is one of the leading causes of death. We need basic agricultural infrastructure. Just little irrigation canals will help water crops that might otherwise die. You need access to education and a way to fundamentally change someone's ability to improve their lot in life is through education. So we try to provide a lot of our food through schools to attract children to those schools who might otherwise be out in the fields working or may not go because their parents don't see a reason for them to go. So we know, you know, if governments just, you know, invest in those basic social services, healthcare, education, rural agricultural infrastructure, clean water, that would work wonders. And really, that's the long-term solution to ending hunger. You know, you also need markets to work. You need, for people who don't have land or aren't going to grow, have an opportunity to go buy in the market, and therefore they need a job to help them to get the resources to do that. So there's a variety of investments that governments can make. It's really, we need to encourage those governments as the international community to make those investments. You know, I would say from my perspective, we see too much spending on military hardware in countries, or we see too much spending just on urban infrastructural projects. There's, you know, in every country of the world, there are certain parts of the country that are politically don't get the attention that other areas might. So it's not that complicated. There really is. There's enough food grown in the world. There's a relatively simple ways to set up safety nets for the most vulnerable families. And we just need to keep encouraging governments and political leaders around the world to do that.
I believe there was a study that was done and a statement by the United Nations itself that it said that during the first each year of the war, we spent over $86 or $87 billion on the Iraqi war, and for that amount of money, the $87 billion, we could feed, educate, and house every human being on the face of the planet. And we choose war.
Our budget is almost $3 billion a year. It's about $2.7 billion. And with that, you know, we're feeding about 88 million people, which is 10% of the hungry poor. So, yeah, you can do the math. It doesn't take that much more, 10 times that amount, 30 billion, to feed all those who are hungry. Now, that doesn't provide them long-term food security. I mean, that's an annual budget, and so nobody wants, in particular, we as the World Food Program do not want to be in business for another 50 to 100 years. We want to go out of business. We want a world free of hunger. That's what we need to work toward. And that requires working outside of the humanitarian sphere as well. I mean, we occupy the humanitarian space, but we need to encourage there to be political action, political improvement of the variety that I was talking about before, to ensure that we can have long-term sustainable solution.
You know, right now, from my understanding, we have about 15 million refugees in the world, if not more. I think that's a low estimate myself, but roughly speaking, how does the food program work within the refugee communities? How do they coordinate such a massive effort, such as Sudan? The failure of the Darfur peace agreement has brought unfathomable misery and starvation to the community. The Iraqi refugees, over 4 million of them as we speak.
Yeah. So refugees are, of course, a huge challenge for us. There's really what's interesting is that, as you said, there's about 15 million refugees in the world, but there's even more what are considered internally displaced persons. A refugee is someone who's had to flee their home due to violence or political persecution, and they cross an international border, so they go from Venezuela, or they go from Sudan to Ethiopia. They then are under the charge of the international community, those who signed the Geneva Convention, because that's most every state in the world agree to care for refugees who've had to flee violence or political persecution. But if you're not a refugee, and you—that is to say, if you flee your home but you stay within Europe, you're considered a displaced person. You're still living within a sovereign state. Still, the responsibility of that same government that may have caused you to provide for you. So, it gets much more difficult in dealing with internally displaced people than it does often refugees, because refugees you may have access to in a third-party country, whereas displaced people. And not have access to them because the government or rebel factions may be cutting you off, assisting them. So,
well, that's exactly what's happening now in the Gaza Strip. Imports and exports have been put to a halt by the occupation. The fact that with the wall and the elongation of the civil war that's now broken out, it is. Become one of the greatest humanitarian crises, and nobody does anything about it because they can't even get in due to the Israeli occupation.
Yeah, we have. I mean, we're feeding about 600,000 people in the West Bank and Gaza, and we of course have access throughout the West Bank. Gaza had been cut off for a couple of weeks, but we do have access now through the Karni crossing. We've got 22 warehouses in Gaza, and our staff, the Palestinian there. So food is getting in now, and we're able to distribute it. We've got about a month's worth of food in there now, which is about what we keep in the warehouse in time. So right now we have access, but that said, 80% of the population in Gaza is dependent on food aid, and. That's the sort of humanitarian reality that we work with. But in places like Darfur, we're feeding almost 3 million people. There are times when we won't be able to access not tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of people due to insecurity. Last month we had 4 trucks that were attacked in Afghanistan. In Colombia, which has the highest number of displaced persons in the Western Hemisphere. There are parts of the country that we can't work in due to violence. So the issue of insecurity is a major one for us in many parts of the world, if not most parts of the world. And it's really one of the few things that can slow us down, because we have really strong logistics capability within the World Food Program. We use ships to move food overseas. We have helicopters and planes and trucks, various sizes. We use donkeys, elephants, mules to move food in really remote areas. At our core, a logistics organization that gets not only food but other humanitarian supplies to the hardest reach areas. So I recall when I was in Afghanistan, there's the Central Highlands in Afghanistan, and in the winter months, October, November, December, January, February, the Central Highlands of Afghanistan are completely cut off because of snow. I mean, you'll have passes there where you'll have 10, 14 feet of snow. Well, what we have to do in a place like that is figure out, okay, well, if we can't get our trucks in, after, say, September, we need to therefore pre-position food in June or July or August in those highlands so that we've already got it up in warehouses or other storage points. If you recall, this November of 2001, it was a very hot place in Afghanistan, and so we couldn't move anything at that time. But when we were able to finally get access to certain areas, we had to bring in avalanche teams. We had to bring in snow removal equipment from Sweden. But we were able to do it. So weather tends not to slow us down too much, but that's because we plan ahead for it. We also do the same with the rainy season in many parts of Africa, because the roads are literally sand. When the rain starts, we can't move our trucks in, so we pre-position food before the rainy season starts. But violence, when they target our drivers, they target humanitarian workers, that does stop us. And the only people that that really suffer from that are those who are trying to access. So we're in a constant state of having to work with state actors and non-state actors to ensure that we have access to the areas that we're hungry kids and hungry mothers and hungry families are living. So
security is a great issue. I want to follow up on the security issue. I think it's a very, very important one, Jordan. We're going to have to take a break right now. Ladies and gentlemen, we're with Jordan Day of the World Food Program, the United Nations World Food Program. Jordan is the director, and you can call and ask Jordan your questions internationally at 888-861-3519, and we'll be back in just a moment after our break.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. And all around me, voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there were signs said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Only on that side was me, you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak radio show. Tonight, the People Speak with Jordan Day of the UN World Food Program. He is the director. If you have any questions for Jordan, please call internationally toll-free at 888-861-3519. Jordan, before we took the break, you were talking about the seriousness of the security situation for the volunteers of the World Food Program. Can you tell us what steps governments helped in taking part in that security for you, or do they?
Well, it, of course, depends on the country and the government. We are working in countries at the invitation of governments, so they tend to want us there, but there are a number of countries in the world where the government may be in complete disarray, like Somalia, where there's essentially no government. So the environment is working with tribal warlords, which is also the case in parts of southern Afghanistan. And certainly in Iraq, you have a...
Now, you were in Afghanistan, Jordan, were you not?
That's correct.
Yeah. And did you have any personal experiences that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, well, sure. I was in Afghanistan right after 9/11. I was there in the first part of 2002. It's truly an extraordinary country, extraordinary people. 26 million people, but it had been through decades of war. So there's half of Kabul had been destroyed. People living in really dire circumstances. I'll never forget meeting a grandmother, old woman whose entire house had been destroyed in some bombing attack at some point years back. And there she was. There had been one room that had survived, and so there was a little roof. The windows were blown out, and she would literally survive off of the bread that she would get once a day at a local bakery. It was a bakery that was run by women, and we were providing them with wheat flour and oil to make this bread. But it was just it was a moment that. That I'll never forget, like a number of other moments, unfortunately, that I've had, where I just have a very vulnerable 70-year-old woman who's had an extraordinary life, who's extraordinarily poor, doesn't have any support network, living among rubble, and has nothing but this blown-out concrete room, of course, no heater, no running water, and surviving just on this, basic minimal amount of food. So that was part of the environment. But it was also, this is a post-conflict, post-war period. So you're also dealing with having landmines throughout the country that not only make it difficult for us to get around, but also make it difficult for families to plant crops.
Well, I think, Jordan, a lot of times people, envision all of these humanitarian crises, and they forget that the people that are going in to save them are locked within that humanitarian crisis, and they become a part of that.
Yeah, well, it's also, most, we have around 12,000 staff around the world, and... 10,500 of those would be national staff. So in a place choose any country in the world, whether it's Afghanistan or Sudan or Colombia or Ethiopia, the staff that you're going to find there for the World Food Program, there'll be, you know, a few internationals like myself, but 95% of the staff will be locals, not more. And so you're also, you know, during you know, the U.S. bombing campaign in Afghanistan, when they were flushing out the Taliban, our staff was there. Our World Food Program staff was there in Kabul, in Kandahar, in Mazar-Sharif. And they were the ones tending to the warehouses. Our staff in just outside of Kabul, I recall at one time, you know, went up and painted the roof to make sure that that everyone knew that it was the United Nations World Food Program roof, and to please, you know, spare it. So, but then they also lived through that trauma, and so they become the ones who are then assisting their neighbors, their brothers and sisters, and others. But they too have been traumatized. So, it's the same was true in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. I was there right after the tsunami, 2 days after the tsunami, and you know, all of our staff is Sri Lankan there, and they had lost family, yet at the same time they were being asked to and were willing to and wanting to come into work and begin the process of ensuring that that we got food out to those who needed it most. So it really is, I mean, it's an extraordinary organization, the World Food Program, but it's really, I mean, the story of the World Food Program is all the national staff around the world, the Ethiopians.
It is definitely a United Nations of activists. We have a caller, Jordan. Mike from California is on the line. Mike, can you give us a question for Jordan?
Hi, Jordan. I was wondering, you know, I've always read of the various celebrity spokespeople for the UN World Food Program. Like, most recently I heard about Drew Barrymore, who actually went to South Africa and participated in the lunch program there. How does somebody like that become involved? Do you guys actively seek them, or do they come forward and offer and volunteer their services? Thank you.
A great question. You know, it was really interesting with Drew Barrymore. She came to us. She had read a story in the New York Times, excuse me, and was so moved by what she read, she called us and said, "Is there anything we can do?" Now, you know, we happen to be a pretty good organization at logistics and moving food, but we're not very sophisticated when it comes to working with movie stars or celebrities. So it was, for us, it was a real, you know, a godsend, a real miracle to have Drew Barrymore call us and say she wanted to help out. And she did go on her own account to Kenya, and she went and worked and visited with some local schools there that had school feeding programs. And she did that on her own. She wrote a story for Marie Claire after that. She came back to the U.S., worked on a movie, then went back out again, and then officially became an ambassador for the World Food Program just a couple months ago. And she's extraordinarily well-versed, articulate, cares a lot, you know, we're thrilled that she cares enough to take the time to work with us.
You know, Jordan, I'm fascinated by the amount of effort that it must take to coordinate such a force that you guys have in the World Food Program. You know, here, just recently, we've gone through the horrific Katrina incident, which was such a mess, a nightmare, really. The devastation, the delayed response of FEMA. How does the World Food Program, did they have any feedback in the Katrina thing? And not just that, how do they coordinate with agencies such as FEMA? Do they work together with them? Do they have areas where they can override them? And what do you think, we could have avoided such a mess? with what happened after Katrina?
Well, we don't work with FEMA only because we don't have operations in the United States. We have operations in you know, in 78 countries, but the U.S. is not one of them. But we do have, in a number of countries, particularly in conflict settings like Afghanistan, like Lebanon, like Iraq, where we have to coordinate with military bodies. Afghanistan, it could be NATO, in Iraq with the U.S. military. And that is in Lebanon with the Israeli Defense Forces. And what we do there is we have something called the UN Joint Logistics Center. And you know, we in Lebanon, for example, had to work with the IDF to ensure that we had, you know, opening spaces to access populations, and they would let us know when they thought it would be free or open. Same is true in Afghanistan. So there is some level of coordination that needs to happen to ensure that the humanitarian, you know, agencies can get out in the middle of conflict. But what, you know, what one of the things I think that Katrina showed the world, or showed the U.S. at least, that we've dealt with in all of our operations. I mean, we've been around for 40 years, and you know, what we've learned is, number one, what's important is an early warning system. You want to have the data, whether it's meteorological data or other indicators about what you expect might happen. And when you have that, then it's easier to plan for a natural disaster when it occurs. But then after disaster occurs, whether it's tsunami or flood, what we do is called a rapid needs assessment. We put our people out, and they quickly survey the affected area in terms of how many people might be affected, where the roads and bridges are down, where the most vulnerable, the poorest families might be. And we get this quick picture, and we go out not just with the World Food Program, but with UNICEF and with WHO, World Health Organization. So it's not just what the food needs are, but also what the water needs might be, or what the medical needs might be. And you often go with a government partner and a non-governmental organization like CARE, CRS, Save the Children. And so you get this quick snapshot of a picture. And then you either have the food or the resources in country, or you have to put out an appeal to the international community, which is really sort of the weakness in the system, that, you know, we need to have more supplies ready to go when a disaster hits. But then we get the food and other humanitarian supplies out to those areas, and then we'll go back a couple weeks into it and do what's not a rapid needs assessment, but a needs assessment, where you can be a little bit more thorough, interview families, talk to heads of the community, and get a better picture of where the needs might remain. And then you determine how long you need to distribute food, whether it's 3 months or 6 months, to help people get back on their feet. And then you ensure that you do a monitoring evaluation of the distribution to make sure the food's going to the right people, make sure it's being utilized correctly.
These types of sounds like an unfathomable job, and I often, like I said, wonder about how these kinds of this magnificent effort comes together and is coordinated. And as I said, here in Katrina, we were such a miserable failure in what many people call the greatest country on planet Earth. Let me ask you, there are a couple of questions. One of our guests in our virtual auditorium had put in a question and is curious as to, and this is from John from Nottingham, asks, how much of the money raised or received in aid is actually spent on food as opposed to other operating costs? And what are some of the operating costs that are involved in this, Jordan?
Sure. Well, we have a 7% overhead. So 93% of the money goes to buying the food or moving the food. If you're not actually buying the commodity, buying the wheat or the corn or the veg oil with the money is going toward the gasoline for the truck, or to pay the driver in the truck, and to ensure that it gets out to the small warehouse where you may have to pay rent on the warehouse, and then out to the school or the small community. So you're paying, the contributions that come to the World Food Program are paying for food and for transport. And then the overhead is for running our offices, for the phone I'm calling you on now, for the computers and the office, chairs and equipment that are needed to coordinate and organize something like this on this scale. But we're lucky that we're a multilateral organization, which means we receive funding from a variety of donor countries as well as individuals, private sector. And so we have a strong funding base and really are able to absorb when one country for whatever reason, financial reasons, economic reasons, can't provide as much as they did in the past, and offset that with what might be increased contributions from other countries. So it is, it's an organization that provides
scale. Well, it sounds like a very, like you guys are doing a heck of a job as far as the amount of monies that do go and get invested into the actual food and the aid to the humanitarian aid, and congratulations. Now, let me ask you one of the greatest questions that a lot of people have. Of course, with the oil for food scandal, the United Nations has been fraught with a scandal after another. How does one trust that our monies go where we want it to go?
Right.
And what are there any assurances that we as a community of people, of givers, have that our monies are going where we want it to go?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is just is constant vigilance. We have an internal auditor and we have external auditors, so we have to pass muster every quarter with our books. The oil for food scandal was something apart from us, but I think important to understand, which was that the UN Security Council passed the oil for food program back in 1995, I think, and what that essentially did was allow the Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein's government, to sell oil on the world market, and then what they were supposed to do is take the proceeds from those sales and use the money to buy food and other humanitarian supplies on the open market. And that was because there had been an economic blockade on Iraq. So the idea was to let's make sure that that the most vulnerable, the children and the elderly, are not unduly harmed by economic sanctions placed on Iraq by the United Nations. So, but what happened there was that in the sale of the oil, which was managed by the Ministry of Trade in Iraq, there was skimming going on by Saddam Hussein and his cronies. And so this is what was discovered in the Volcker report. The food that was being distributed was being distributed by the Iraqi government in the south, central government, right? They have these, a setup which is frankly still in place, which is these little small storefronts, where families go and pick up their food, and most families at that time, 1995 to 2004, had a government ration card, and they would go and get the food there. But the whole program was intended to offset the effects of the economic sanctions. It was a program, while called Oil for Food, was not entirely food. It also provided other humanitarian supplies, agricultural supplies, tractors, medical supplies, etc. So, but it had the unfortunate title of Oil for Food, and we have the title of the World Food Program. So it's often confused that we may have been part of that, but we were not.
I think an interesting thing that as I was doing some of the work trying to prepare for some of this was that it was the United States and Britain that actually designed the Oil for Food program. They wrote the rules that allowed Saddam Hussein to choose his trading partners, his banks, his consultants, Every one of the 30,000 contracts that were passed through the program, they also held up over 5,000 concerns about materials that could be used for weapons of mass destruction. But never once were they concerned about any of the corruption that was going on. So I think that what really happened was kind of a coordinated effort on all parts to encourage what I found to be a tragedy, because the UN took the fall for this.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, I know that you had told me earlier that the United Nations and the United Nations World Food Program are not really the same entity.
Well, there's the United Nations Secretariat, which is based in New York, and is where the UN Security Council is housed, as well as the UN General Assembly, and that's where the political debates take place. But the UN has also got a number of parts to it, and including humanitarian agencies, which is what we're considered. And we're a humanitarian agency like UNICEF, like the UN High Commission for Refugees, like the World Health Organization. And what's interesting about our funding, for example, is that it's completely voluntary. So every year, frankly every day, we have to go out and appeal for funding to assist those in Darfur or elsewhere. There's no assessed funding. And so we're just in a different financial situation in that we have to continually show that we're doing well and doing it efficiently for donor countries like the U.S. or Europe or Japan to continue to give to us. There are other agencies within the UN and the UN Secretariat that receive assessed funding from member governments, and that's important to ensure predictability, to be able to look beyond 1 or 2 year budgets. But the UN is it's a complex organization. It's wide ranging. It's got a number of agencies. We're the largest of the UN agencies by budget and by the number of people we serve. But we're a humanitarian agency. We're not a political agency, we don't have a whole lot to do with the debates that take place in the UN General Assembly and the UN Security Council. Although ultimately, we all report to the Secretary General.
Well, we have a question here from Jane from Australia, and she is curious: how does Zimbabwe get food if Mugabe doesn't allow any UN food aid in? So how do you get around something like that?
Well, President Mugabe has been inconsistent, I should say, on this issue. Like I said, we have to be invited into a country by the government to work. Mugabe has held at times in the past that there was not food shortages, that they had enough food to feed the people, and they did not need the assistance of the international community. And I think a lot of that was an issue, frankly, of politics and pride. He did not want to make it look like his country was in need. Well, that has changed this year. We were feeding around 200 to 300, helping feed 200 to 300,000 people in Zimbabwe up until just a couple months ago, and we've done a recent crop assessment there, and they are facing a huge the drought in the south, a huge deficit in food availability, and we have essentially a food crisis on our hands now in Zimbabwe. And Mugabe, President Mugabe, recognizes that. He's allowed us to work there, and it has been supportive of the numbers that we've been using in terms of what we think the need is going to be. And we're looking at maybe 3 to 4 million people now needing food assistance in Zimbabwe. And so, the government has been, at this point, as of today, supportive of us being able to work there. It's never easy. It's a highly politically charged environment. But as of now, as of today, as of, you know, this year, this season, he's been more open to allowing us to work there. That wasn't the case last year.
Did he actually invite you, the World Food Program in?
He's allowing us to stay. We've been there for years. Zimbabwe used to be
allowing
the,
us to stay. I like that. He's not necessarily inviting
Zimbabwe
you, but
used
he's
to be
allowing
the
you to be there.
Of Africa. I mean, we used to buy food in Zimbabwe and truck it elsewhere, but not now.
Absolutely stunning and amazing. And what is your personal... we've only got a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you, Jordan... do you think we'll ever end world hunger?
I do. I do. I actually, you know, there will always be a certain percentage of the population in need, but you simply need to set up safety nets like they've done in Europe and the U.S. But I think large-scale hunger will end. And we have the example, frankly, of China that has done well. They've moved a couple hundred million people out of poverty and hunger. They still have a long way to go, but... you have the example of Chile that has had remarkable progress in the last 30 years. South Korea has done well. So they're a good example. You know, it requires good governance and it requires the right investments, as I said earlier. You know, we might need a good governance and investments, the right investments to get there. But I'm optimistic. I mean, it's really not that complicated. But there, you know, the challenges tend to be political and frankly security. I mean, the most vulnerable people tend to be those who have had to flee their homes due to violence. And so part of the equation, in addition to good governance, in addition to the right budgetary decisions, is any, you know, conflict as well. I mean, where there's conflict, you're going to find hunger.
And let me ask you something, one more question, Jordan, before we end it. As an American, do you believe that America is doing all it can, truly, to help be a positive role model in the ending of hunger in the world?
Well, I think, you know, there's, of course, always more that can be done. But as an American, I think you should be proud of the amount of support that the U.S. government has given the U.S. Agency for International Development and the U.S. Department of Agriculture really have been extraordinary in funding the World Food Program. About half our funding, that is 43% this year, came from the United States government. That makes them by far the largest donor to the World Food Program. And frankly, it's you know, it's the generosity of not only the American taxpayers but American farmers and the you know, processing and milling industries that have been supportive of that assistance. So there's always more that can be done. You know, we might suggest improvements here and there and how we're funded or how the program works. But that said, you know, we would be half the organization we are without the U.S. support. So Americans should be proud of the assistance that the U.S. government gives to the World Food Program. Really, truly, it's extraordinary.
Well, I know for sure that Americans are proud of you and the work that you do. Thank you very much for being with us tonight, Jordan. Tonight's guest, ladies and gentlemen, was Jordan Day, director of the UN World Program, Feeding the Hungry in the World. A very, very noble project. Good luck to you and continue the good work.
Thank you so much for the work you do. I really appreciate you you taking the time to talk about these issues. Thank you for having us on.
Well, it's been our honor and our distinct pleasure to have you here with us. Tomorrow's guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Congressman Paul Findley, author of They Dare to Speak Out and Silent No More. That'll be a special show Wednesday, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Eastern, in the People Speak, Social Issues. Thank you very much for being with us once again, everybody. It is our pleasure. And don't forget, when the people speak, we make a difference. Good night, everybody.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. me as I went walking that ribbon of highway. I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. And all around me, voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and